everything is gone.
Everything's gone?
Well, like all the evidence, you know, yeah. Like a month has gone by. But
case has gone cold.
It's a cold rabbit case. But during the whole month, Susan Vickery is just like, again, like turning her rabbit sanctuary into the Fort Knox of rabbit sanctuaries. She's installing security cameras. Like a month later, RCMP concludes its investigation. No arrests. And now you see this slow shift where people were once mad at Barbara Smith. Now everyone's starting to be like, well, what's Susan Vickery doing to protect it? She's supposed to be saving these rabbits. Instead, there's so much rabbit blood on her hands. And then just over the next many years, there's this paranoia that starts building around the Coombs Sanctuary. There's supposed to be 500 rabbits here, but I only counted 40 today. Where are the other ones? Is she lying about that? Is she hiding rabbits? Is she covering up rabbit deaths?
Again, nothing seemed to be terribly organized. But on the other hand, Susan was trying very hard. And, you know, she was working her buns off trying to make it work.
Susan Vickery, to be fair, she was not equipped to handle, like, this amount of publicity. She was...
Rabbits.
Yeah, or rabbits.
Who's equipped to deal with this many rabbits? Like, that's just not a thing that you can expect from anybody.
There was a lot of pressure because I'm pretty sure this is the most public rabbit relocation in the history of rabbit relocations. At least in British Columbia.
To my knowledge.
But this kind of paranoia just keeps prompting the rabbit activists to just ask anyone to go investigate. They're reaching out to news organizations being like, can you please go investigate the Coombs facility? Everything is not as it seems, and I need you to tell me the answers. And so, like, small town newspapers are going, and they're reporting, like, everything is fine here. And then the rabbit groups are like, why are the newspapers covering this up now? But then there's another incident at the Coombs facility.
Of course.
Two rabbits go missing.
Just two?
Just two.
They have that deep records of it that they know exactly when these two? Oh, yeah, Betty and Susan there left. We know exactly which ones.
Yeah, they do roll call, and they're like, Betty? Susan Vickery's like, how did they escape? I've been fortifying this sanctuary for the last 3 years. How did they get out? And then a volunteer shows her how easy it is for a rabbit to actually get out. You move the food bucket, and there's a giant hole in the fence that anyone can just grab a rabbit from.
Oh.
And then this revelation just, like, sparks this thought in Susan Vickery. That explains why so many rabbits have gone missing over all these years. She just realized now.
She was really trying to do her best. But when she started talking about this, and you start thinking, this is now tipped over the edge into true paranoia.
So these rabbits go missing, and Susan Vickery is like, it must be an inside job. Well, of course it is. I've been betrayed by my volunteers. I can trust no one. I only have myself and these rabbits.
It's like the mob.
And then she says this to the paper. It didn't dawn on me that it was the good-looking rabbits that were going missing.
I thought these people were like, oh my God, care for everything, care for every living being. And now they're like, oh yeah, there's definitely some real ugly butts in there that were.
Yeah. But yeah, all the good looking rabbits have been taken. Suddenly, like, everything's clicking, you know? Mm. I just imagine Susan Vickery in her house staring at a wall, and there's, like, photos of, like, handsome rabbits and, like, pretty rabbits. And there's, like, a big question mark in the middle being like, why these rabbits? And there's, like, red yarn attached to all of them. And then she goes like, I got it. So Susan Vickery's having a really hard time in Coombs.
Yeah. Coombs is having a hard time too, I'm sure.
This is a classic lose, lose, lose. And so eventually what she does is it comes time for her to renew her permits to keep them in Coombs. And she chooses not to.
Whoa.
She sends them away to Alberta.
What's in Alberta?
Another rabbit sanctuary she owns.
So she thinks it's just that it's Coombs is the problem.
And Judith Lavoie, the reporter, read me an email she got from Susan, where she's now living in Nova Scotia.
I just looked at one of the last emails that she sent me, but she said, I took six UV rabbits along with me. They required special care, and I didn't want to burden Wally and Doreen with that. They're the couple who run my Alberta sanctuary. I don't know how many UVic rabbits remain there. Not many, perhaps three or four. I'm the only one who had recognized them apart from the others.
So there's not very many left, but...
Yeah. Rabbit legacy is slowly dwindling. Mm-hmm.
Unless we talk about the Texas rabbits.
The Texas rabbits.
So, Laura Leeshaw, as you remember, real estate agent from Vancouver, who refinanced her mortgage to save rabbits.
In this economy?
In that economy, in 2010.
Still not great.
She has made a quest out of these rabbits. She could only get export permits. So she has to find somewhere in the U.S. that will take up to 1,000 rabbits.
Oh my God.
That's what her permit says. And in her research, she comes across this book. And this book is called Noah and the Bunnies. It's about a one-legged pigeon who raises a litter of orphaned baby rabbits. And it's a true story.
True story.
True
story. One-legged pigeon.
Racing rabbits. And the story is written by a woman named...
Georgianne
Lenham.
I'm the CEO and founder of a sanctuary rescue ranch in East Texas.
And the ranch is called Wild Rose Rescue Ranch.
For rabbits. Or for any animal.
Just for all animals, wow. Including rabbits. So Laura Leeshaw contacts the woman who wrote the book and is like, I've got a bunch of rabbits and they need to go somewhere soon or they will all die. Because...
Are you going to be the one-legged pigeon here?
I couldn't believe there were actually, you know, so many at the campus. And then she said they were being poisoned, and then to hear they were stomped on, I mean, that's the most hideous thing I can even imagine. You know, they were looked at as vermin, as just terrible.
Like, if they didn't get the rabbits off campus and move somewhere quickly, they would have to be euthanized.
Because this was still in the fall of 2010?
Yeah, like the Coombs and Texas events are happening simultaneously. So, Georgianne's like...
We'll help, but we cannot absolutely not afford anything. You know, you'd have to support them. And yeah, we're on a fixed income.
There's some kind of agreement reached.
So we talked, my husband and I talked and prayed about it and said, okay, we can take up... I mean, we've got 46 acres, so we have room as long as you promise. You know, that they will be spayed and neutered and commit to caring for them.
And it's kind of a she-said-she-said situation where Georgianne's like, Laura Leeshaw agreed to pay for all of this forever. And Laura Leeshaw's like, no, I didn't. Why would I do that? But ultimately, it's agreed that these rabbits will go to Texas. So Laura Leeshaw starts driving them down batch by batch in her Dodge Caravan.
We went through during the worst parts of winter because we, as I say, we had to keep doing the trips. The mountain passes were being closed from snow. We were having to overnight in places we hadn't expected. Worried sick about the bunnies and were they warm enough. But the bunnies did great.
Yeah, how long does it take to drive to Texas?
A long time.
A long time.
A long time.
And she's just moving them herself.
Yeah, she does three trips.
Wow.
And two of the trips are her. Just by herself. Eventually they get there. And then stuff gets pretty out of control again.
Obviously. I mean, these are cursed rabbits.
So the town of White House, which is in eastern Texas, and a month after the rabbits, like all the rabbits get there in January, the town passes an ordinance.
All of a sudden, the city manager walks up and hand delivers a proposed ordinance that was going to limit everybody to four animals.
And Georgianne has just acquired 200 UVic rabbits.
But wait, so wait, I guess all her animals that she had before for rescue, like, would she just have, like, random ones?
They had a lot of dogs and a lot of horses.
Hmm.
Yeah, they just, like, collected whatever animal needed rescuing.
The city would call us out and say, hey, can you guys go get, there's a fawn on the side of the road, or there was a raccoon that had been hit by a car, and a vulture. Bob and I would always take off and, you know, help the city every chance we got. You know, they had no problems with us until the news about the rabbits.
And she sues the city.
Oh, my God.
She's like, this ordinance should not apply to me because, A, we're on farmland, and B, you know, we're an animal rescue ranch.
and we became a nonprofit 501c3 in 09, so knew we were perfectly legal. It didn't make any sense.
Did the ordinance come out from anything, or was it specifically directed at her?
She thinks that it was directed at her. So, the case.
It was dismissed for lack of jurisdiction.
And now the ordinance is in effect.
They figured they won, and they could come and get any animals in excess of four. They showed up with several, I forget how many cop cars were here, and people climbing the fence. They were wearing their gear with the bulletproof vests and their guns. And there were probably seven or eight cop cars, at least two, maybe three animal control trucks. The cops even told me that even a goldfish counted as a pet.
And these ranch owners are just like, what are we going to do? Like, we're stuck here. And so...
It was during that time frame that we found the place south of us. It's in a town called New Summerfield.
They just leave. Like, they find a new ranch. They move to another county with another ranch. And yeah, they just move all their animals there.
And live happily ever after?
No.
Oh, no, of course not.
While they're there, they start figuring all this stuff out.
I have suspicions of, that they see you trying to get the property. And I think the rabbits were just an excuse to step up and say, hey, try to run us off.
And then all this stuff starts happening back in White House, where they're from. So the police chief gets charged with assault, which relates to an incident involving the wife of one of his officers. That charge is dismissed, but he still resigns. And then a few months later, the city manager also resigns after an investigation into that same incident found that he'd been carrying an open alcohol container on city property.
What?
So all these major players, just they're out of the picture now. So Georgianne and her husband Bob, by the way, they move back to the old ranch. The heat's gone. They laid low for long enough. They could finally move back here. But the ordinance is still in effect. A lawyer approaches them and is like, I've heard your story. I will do this case pro bono.
Rabbit activist lawyer.
Yeah. And so he brings the case to the correct court, and the jury rules in the ranch's favor. And now they're just living day by day on this ranch in eastern Texas, and they have 100 euthic rabbits left.
Still?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And that's the story of the euthic rabbits.
What did you learn?
I think I just learned that people do crazy things for animals.
That's your Canada Land. I hope you like this episode. We're always looking for stories that are just different and are going to surprise you or inform you and come from different parts of this country and expose you to different voices. You can email me at jesse@canadaland.com. I read them all. We're on Twitter at Canada Land. Our website is canadaland.com. This episode comes to us from CFUV. It was originally produced by Andrew Hines in 2019. Additional production and editing for our version from Tristan Capicchione, our audio editor and technical producer, and from our news editor, Jonathan Goldsby. Special thanks to associate producer Cassidy Villabrin-Barakas. Our managing editor is Annette Ejofor. I'm your host, Jesse Brown. Our theme music is by So Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV, 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it. Emily Nicolas, columnist and host of our podcast Detour.
Hi, how are you?
I'm okay. On the show today, Emily, enough is enough in Quebec. We are going to talk about a defiant open letter demanding an end to the toxicity in political discourse, which has been signed by hundreds of scholars and writers. Welcome back to Shortcuts, where we talk shit about the news.
Thank you. It's going to be fun. We're discussing Canada's two best provinces, basically.
Emily, I'm so glad that you're with us here today because this really remarkable open letter was published in Le Devoir, the Quebec newspaper, which you write for. You're not an author.
I'm not the one who made that published, no.
You didn't write this letter, nor are you among the almost 400 people who signed it. And it's like a who's who of scholars, academics, writers. I'll confess I noted like Charles Taylor's name, but there's a lot of French-Canadian names.
Yeah, I mean, there's comedians, there's some actors that have been, you know, pretty well-known in Quebec television. There's, yeah, obviously some media personalities as well. There's Spin It Up McQuaid, who's the host of the, I guess, the current, the French version of The Current. Yeah, there's a whole bunch of names in there if you have an eye for who's who in Quebec media and culture and universities. Mm-hmm. There's a whole bunch of names there, yeah.
It really came across as like this is civil society with like a cry from the heart here. And can you tell everybody what this letter said?
Okay, so there's a context of it's now been 2 weeks. At the end of March, there's this guy called Gilles Proulx, who has been a fixture of private radio in Quebec for decades. And he was on Cube Radio, which is the Quebecor web mm-hmm. radio, with host Richard Martineau, who is one of the, or if not the most well-known columnist in Quebec, who is also a Cube Radio host. And he said, while he was on air, he insulted the members of the Quebec Solidaire Party, the members of the caucus, so the basically the MNAs, even said comments that sounded like vague threats against them, like they shouldn't exist. It was not the first time that he did that. He also said something to that effect to the members of the caucus of the Quebec Liberal Party. But Quebec Solidaire reacted that time and said, you know, you cannot have a person on the air saying things that sounds like death threats to MNAs and people not reacting. This is over the line.
Reading a translation of the letter, Gilles Proulx said that members of Quebec Solidaire are bastards and gangrene and that members of the Liberal Party are to be shot.
That created a whole uproar, except for the Parti Québécois, the three MNAs that are left. There was almost a unanimous motion at the National Assembly to condemn that guy. Even the premier, so the CAQ, the leading party, came out and said, okay, we need to be careful about what is said in the media in Quebec, and Gilles Proulx needs to, you know, he needs to apologize. There's been a lot of pressure for him to be taken off the air. But it has created a broader conversation, because at the same time, another person working from Quebec, one of their other stars, Mathieu Bocoté, wrote also a column using basically a podcast that he heard, taking a quote out of context in that podcast, accusing Léa Clermont-Dion. She's a pretty big personality, and especially in Quebec feminism, and basically calling her an anti-white racist. She's white, by the way, and wrote a whole column basically saying that she went over the line. She's anti-white racist, and here's why this person is, etc. So Léa Clermont-Dion reacted on her Instagram and on social media, essentially saying, this is also over the line. You cannot, like, you can criticize my idea, but like this kind of name calling is maybe libel, and that I'm going to be looking at my options, essentially, is what she said. And so that created a whole bunch of reactions from other people who had been the target of such tactics that are not MNAs, that are not elected officials, because mostly the conversation on in terms of, you know, people throwing, saying things that lead to violence has been very limited, not just in Quebec, but across this country, a lot of the time to either elected officials or journalists. But what we've been seeing, and especially if you look at the links, there's a lot of hyperlink in the letters that are giving examples of some of the other people that have been on the receiving end of such treatment, and a lot of the links link to things that have been said by, I guess, most of them would be coming from either Mathieu Bocoté, Richard Martineau, Sophie Durocher, so some of the stars of Québécois, but they're not the only ones doing it. The letter is basically saying that, you know, there's been essentially a way of, instead of talking about ideas, you're just using your column and your tens, if not hundreds of thousands of followers to direct basically insults at private individuals who are either sometimes just tweeting, sometimes just making a media, a social media post, sometimes they're just on a podcast having an hour-long conversation. You're taking a quote out of context and you make it the worst thing that was ever said on air by misquoting that person and just calling that person a woke, you know, threat to democracy, civilization, insulting, like the level of language that is then used creates a wave of insults coming from social media and death threats in a lot of cases that make people shut down their account and makes people basically disappear from the public sphere because they're just afraid of the consequences once they've been named as a target. And so this letter is like, here is a list of names of people who've received that treatment before. And we think this is dangerous for a democracy. And we think there's a business model essentially that profits from that. And we think that this is not what media should be doing. Well, over close to 400 people signed that. So I think it's a, you know, it's a pretty big deal.
And even when somebody feels compelled to shut down their social media account because of this kind of toxic commentary, that's not necessarily the end of it.
One thing that could be tempting to do is to go back into the specifics of, you know, each instance of a person tweeting something or saying something and that being taken out of context. So we go back and analyze, like, but did they say something wrong? And it could be tempting to try to do that in the interest of, you know, accuracy and trying to paint a whole picture. And just to give you a sense of context, the letter itself was written by some people who wanted to remain essentially as some of the signatories, but didn't want to put their name forwards as the author. This is why if you go on the DeWalls website, you're going to see that there's this one professor, Mathieu Marion, who's been named as the author and everybody else's signatories, but it's just because he was like, yeah, I'm not at risk as much as a backlash. I'm going to be putting my name forward. But people were just even afraid of being a torch bearer for this letter is what I understood from the conversation I know happened as this got published. And so it tells you the level of fear that people have in terms of having their own behavior inspected when it comes to them just saying we should be careful about online violence. Because that's the thing. It's like there's things that we've learned about violence against women in general, because it is in most instances violence against women, and that we seem to forget when it comes to online hate, which is that it's not about what the woman was wearing. It's about the attack that she's received. There are ways in which we can analyze what the person was saying. But because we a lot of time confuse actually between criticism of what a person says and what I'm describing, which is insults, an attack that leads to threats. Those are very different things. And because we're confused about that, we want to inspect what the person said that triggered criticism, but don't realize that actually what we're describing is not criticism. It's verbal violence that leads to threats of physical violence. My frustration is that a lot of the time when people are on the receiving end of that, sometimes maybe they've said something that, you know, politically a little bit, you know, risky or something. But the point is, women's freedom of expression should not be conditional to them being perfect. And that seems to be the case, is that if you're not perfect, you don't risk being criticized for your ideas. You risk having your children threatened.
Yeah.
That's just never, never okay. That's been the situation for a lot of the women who are speaking up or just expressing ideas on Twitter. Even when they are doing things that are incredibly prudent, there's still that. That's the part that I think I wish people understood. If we're not making that distinction, it's actually reproducing a cycle that we were very willing to get out of when it came to analyzing violence against women in the physical world and sexual violence. And we seem to still be confused when it comes to online violence, that it's not about what the person said. It's about saying and naming that those kind of reactions are never okay, regardless of what the person said. And we're not getting that, I feel, as a society yet. There is still that impulse to just inspect what the person said instead of inspecting what the reaction is and why that reaction is over the line. I really wish we could change that. I don't think we can have a mature conversation on online hate if we don't look at the way we're focusing on the person on the receiving end of that violence rather than the person doing the hate.
I think that's a good way to think about it. This open letter, I think, it's like, maybe everybody should just chill. There is a commercial infrastructure at work that, like, really only profits one side. Everybody needs to breathe a second and think about what kind of, like, world we want to live in, what kind of conversation we want to have. And, like, even when you take it to, like, this being part of our jobs, like what kind of scummy business do you want to be in? Like, is this the stock and trade of what it is to be in the discourse, to be a person of letters, to be in the public conversation? The quotes that are cited in this piece are pretty damning. Emily, like, what's the response been to the letter? Has it had an impact?
I think so. Obviously, a lot of people are sharing, quietly sharing, just like saying, here's this letter, and I'm not going to say anything about it, because pointing at power or people with a lot of clout in Quebec is, I mean, Quebec is so small, right? So people are careful about what they say. But it's one of those things where there's a lot of, I guess, corridor, hallway conversations about it. Everybody's noticed that it's out there. I think there needs to be more work to understand exactly how that functions. And the reason it's becoming, I'm using the word business model, part of it is because, you know, just algorithms have been tweaked since the invention of social media, and now it's basically like rage farming. The more reactions, the stronger the emotions you're getting, the more your piece is going to be circulated. And at this point, if a lot of traditional media are depending on social media to get traffic to their website, they're going to be producing content that follows, you know, Facebook rules, which is the more egregious, the better. If people are struggling for profit and there's been some layoff in some industries, they're just going to be pushing out more of that content. There's a direct business incentive to push out more of that kind of content. And so I think it's really important to look beyond the individuals and who said what, and also look at why is it that this kind of content is being pushed out more and more.
Emily, it's time to duly note things. Emily, what have you today?
I just wanted you to go watch this YouTube video now. It's been put on YouTube and it's on Instagram and it's everywhere. Last weekend in Montreal was held for the seventh year now an event that's called Gala Dynasty, which is basically like BET award for Quebec. And there was this video that was presented at the beginning of the gala that is essentially a satire of Black Panther 2.
Au Québec, le milieu de la télévision vit des moments extrêmement difficiles. Les codes d'écoute sont au plus bas, surtout auprès des jeunes. C'est la catastrophe.
And what it's doing is presenting the Quebec media industry and culture industry as people who are trying to mine what they call the divernium. Essentially, they're just looking for diversity to put on the air. And the name of the video is Quebconda. So Quebconda is just not giving the divernium anymore because they haven't been responsible with it. So essentially, it's a way of criticizing how the media industry has been incredibly, well, I guess, exclusive and or just haven't treated the talent right when they've had access to it. But it's done in a way that's absolutely hilarious because essentially you have a Black Panther, a Canadian version of Black Panther now. And so it's obviously creating a lot of reactions. Even in the silence that it's creating, you're seeing that it's an reaction because people are just taking it in. It's actually hilarious that you have actually a full-blown, you know, short movie that was now created just to basically discuss lack of diversity in the media and on television, but in a way that's actually a satire and using Black Panther and just like, yeah, it's a whole thing. Go check it out on YouTube. It's like Quebconda, so like Queb as in the first letters of Quebec and then Conda as in Wakanda. And you can check it out. It's both hilarious and very informative about the current state of the industry and the tensions that are playing out in Quebec media.
Quebconda, I'll check it out. Duly noted. Emily, that is Shortcuts for this week. Thank you for joining me for it.
Thank you.
We're on Twitter at CanadaLand, and I can be emailed at jesse@canadaland.com, and I read all of the emails I receive there. Emily, where can people find you?
People can find me on Twitter, Emily_NI, and people can find me in Le Devoir for my columns there too.
And posting Detour.
Of course, it's like such the obvious thing. I'm not even naming it. You can find me where you're finding this podcast and on our own feed now as well. You can subscribe to Detour.
Yeah, subscribe directly to Detour. This episode is produced by Aviva Lassard with additional production by Tristan Capicchione. Our managing editor is Annette Ejofor. Theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.
Mm-hmm.